From Alabama to New Mexico, California to West Virginia, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, in a case that has far-reaching implications for worker freedom, the Supreme Court will decide if government employees can be forced to pay fees to public sector labor unions. Nathan McGrath of the Fairness Center is here to explain. Two special congressional elections and significant developments in U.S. Senate races dominate political news. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth is here with the real story. It is a streetcar that nobody desires. Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine are here to talk about Washington, D.C.'s streetcar boondoggle. And it is no coincidence that the rise in school shootings parallels the decline of Christian influence in the public square. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Public sector workers may not have to pay union dues, but they are forced to pay fees for union representation, whether they want it or not. Now the Supreme Court will decide whether or not that is constitutional. Nathan McGrath is vice president and litigation counsel at the Fairness Center. He sat in last week as the high court held oral arguments, and he is here to discuss the case. Nathan, welcome to American Radio Journal. Nathan, when we talk about the Janus case, as with most cases before the Supreme Court, most people don't know them by name, maybe not even know what it is at issue here. So let's start from ground zero. Tell us what the Janus case is and what is the point of argument, the point of contention before the Supreme Court of the United States.
Thanks so much for having me. The Janus case, very interesting case. It's going to have large impact one way or another. The main issue in this case is it constitutional to force a non-member to pay union fees? And what I mean by a non-member is someone who is in a bargaining unit that is represented by a union but is not a union member. So therefore, the union can't make them pay dues. But currently, right now, in 22 states in America, they are able to have them pay what's called sometimes a fair share fee or an agency fee, union fee, those types of things. So the case centers around that. Is it constitutional to be able to force these non-members to pay those types of fees?
So what you are saying is if I work, and I'm assuming we're talking primarily here about the public sector, but if I...
this case focuses strictly on the public sector.
So if I work for my state government and I don't want to be represented by AFSCME or any other union, I don't have to pay dues to be a member of that union, but they're still going to dock my pay for whatever services is that they believe they're rendering on my behalf, and I have no say in it?
That's correct. You're not a union member, so they can't charge you dues, but they can charge you a fee for representation and whatever they deem as chargeable within the confines of the law for representation or opinions or positions that you probably likely have never asked them for and maybe don't even want.
Why then is this such a big issue? Is it something that I'm assuming the unions are pushing? It means a lot of money to them. But aside from that, is there other special interests at play here?
Well, I think it's a big issue because the public sector unions have really been growing, and they see it as this ruling could affect over 5 million public employees in 22 different states. And they would argue that, well, if a person can resign from the union and doesn't have to pay anything for the services, at least they're saying they provide, why wouldn't everyone just do that, whether they agree with us or not?
If they are, in fact, providing valuable services, wouldn't the marketplace cause people to want to buy it anyhow?
Well, that's certainly the argument, right? Coming back in a free market, in a market-centric sort of situation, if you're offering a service that these people want, they would step up and pay for it. But this compulsory fee truly kind of locks in people who have already said, we don't want your services, we don't want your representation. And this would make the union have to really provide something for people to step up and pay for now.
Does this, Nathan, impact every state, or are there only some states that would be affected by this ultimate ruling by the court?
This ruling would mainly have an impact in 22 states. So the other 28 states have some type of law on the books, often called right-to-work laws, where public sector, union non-members already, they can't be forced to pay these fees. So, but there's 22 states where the law provides, in one way or another, for non-members to be forced to pay these fees.
Now, this case has landed before the Supreme Court of the United States. There recently were oral arguments. You were there. Tell us a bit about how that went.
Yeah, it was very interesting. So I was actually at some predecessor cases as well that took up the same issue. And so it was interesting, at least for me, to take a look at the justices at oral argument to see if they had changed position or if they were bringing up anything new. And I guess the big news of the day there was what a lot of people are looking for as the ninth justice in the fifth vote on one side or the other, Justice Gorsuch. He said nothing. He was completely silent. He took a lot of notes, but not a peep from him. And I would say my main observation, at least, was the four on either side seemed pretty entrenched in their ways. I can't imagine that they're changing their tune anytime soon on this issue.
Have there been similar cases involving union fees and union power that came before the courts? And if there have, how have the justices divided on those cases?
Right. So most immediately, you had a case coming out of the Ninth Circuit in California. It was called Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. And that was argued in 2016. And between argument and an opinion being rendered, Justice Scalia unfortunately passed away, and so the court tied 4-4. And so that's why this case has a lot of significance in that now you have a full court and you have a fifth vote. So one interesting note actually from the oral arguments when I was there, Justice Breyer seemed to be offering kind of a middle-of-the-road solution, and he was trying to figure out a way, it seems, for the court not to completely overrule Abood, which is the case that allows these forced fees, but to maybe see if he could pull some votes that way.
Justice Kennedy frequently is a pivotal vote in any of these arguments. Where has he been in the past, and what was his reaction during oral arguments?
Yes, so Justice Kennedy is a very strong believer in First Amendment rights, and on this particular issue, he has been, and from oral arguments in Janus, appears to be very solidly in the camp of Mr. Janus and getting overturning Abood. In fact, he had one of, I think, probably the most quotable back and forth with the union attorney, where he asked the union attorney, well, if we overrule Abood, and this is, of course, just the general language, but not directly quoting him, but, you know, if we overrule Abood, will the unions lose political power? And the union attorney said, yes. Well, Justice Kennedy kind of kicked back and threw up his hands and said, well, isn't that the case? And indeed, it really is the central point here, because the union's argument, they're saying that, well, these non-members never pay for politics. We've taken that away. All they're paying for is the collective bargaining expenses. But that's kind of interesting if the unions will say, well, if you don't allow them to pay for the collective bargaining expenses, we're going to lose political power. So obviously those fees and what they're claiming as collective bargaining is also tied to politics. So it was a very interesting exchange.
What a shock. The unions are trying to protect political power by forcing people to pay dues or fees in this particular case. So we've had oral arguments. What happens next? When do we get a decision?
I would say probably the safe bet is that your decision is going to come sometime in June. Typically, these very large kind of blockbuster cases are released towards the very, very end of the term, which ends at the end of June. There's a possibility it comes earlier, but that'd be my bet.
We have been talking with Nathan McGrath, who is Vice President and Litigation Counsel of the Fairness Center. They have been arguing the Janus v. AFSCME case before the Supreme Court of the United States. It has to do with forcing workers against their will to pay so-called fair share fees to labor unions. Nathan, if we have listeners who would like to get more information, perhaps learn a little bit more about the Fairness Center, tell us a bit about the Fairness Center and where they can go to get that information.
The Fairness Center is a non nonprofit public interest law firm. We represent those who are injured by public sector union officials, and you can find us at fairnesscenter.org or call us at 844-293-1001.
Nathan McGrath of the Fairness Center. Nathan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth has been keeping an eye on a growing number of special elections. And also, we are, of course, in an election cycle. So we have primary campaign maneuvering going on in various states. We're going to touch upon a couple of them today. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Let's start out with special elections. We had one just a couple of days ago in Arizona. What happened in Arizona?
Yeah, the incumbent, Trent Franks, had to resign under scandal late last year. Arizona election law is very quick to remedy these vacancies. So they had a primary just this past week, like you said. It's a very conservative district just south of Phoenix. And Debbie Lesko, state legislature, won that. She is very conservative. She will most likely be a member of the House Freedom Caucus, and she will be a very reliable vote in Congress. Now, I should say that this was just the primary. There is going to be a general election in, I believe, May, but that's pretty much a formality. This is such a conservative district that Lesko is sure to win that.
Well, that's what's happening in the western part of the country. Let's go east now to Pennsylvania, suburban Pittsburgh, to be precise, where, again, scandal has created an open seat. We have a special election coming up on March 13th. What is the lay of the land in the Keystone State?
So this is the nationalized race. This is the race that, if your listeners remember Georgia 6 from last year, this is the race to be the next attempt for Democrats to try and pick up a very Republican district. I don't know the numbers, but Trump won this district handily. Yet because of the problems the administration is having and Republicans in general, there is the belief that Democrats can pick up this seat. Connor Lamb, the Democrat, is very polished. He's a young man. He's a veteran. He's distanced himself from Nancy Pelosi, so he's trying to portray himself as a moderate. In the wake of the Florida school shooting, however, he has said that he doesn't believe in any new gun laws. And this is in a very conservative district, so he's trying to pitch himself as a moderate on guns, but that could upset his Democrat base. The Republican, Rick Saccone, is a very conservative state legislator, but he's kind of the standard Republican out of central casting. He's not as dynamic as Connor Lamb, and he's not as energetic, but this is his race to win. And if he loses it, then Democrats are going to be extremely emboldened to win a lot of seats in November. So it's a big race, and millions of dollars are being spent. And we'll find out, like you said, on March 13th, who's going to win that.
So a bellwether race taking place in Pennsylvania. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, this is an election year. And we have the entire United States House of Representatives and a third of the U.S. Senate up for election this year. One of those elections is in the state of Mississippi and some interesting developments there.
Yeah, you know, right now Republicans have the majority in the Senate, 51-49. So you're basically seeing a lot of battles between Republicans and Democrats. But never can an election cycle go by where a Republican doesn't challenge an incumbent Republican in the GOP primary, and Mississippi is where it's going to be. Chris McDaniel tried to defeat Senator Thad Cochran back in 2014. He won the primary but lost to Cochran in the runoff, and that was always a hill that conservatives valiantly died on but vowed to fight again, and that's what McDaniel's trying to do. He's trying to go after Senator Roger Wicker, who's very much a swamp Republican senator. He has like a 60 or 70% on the Club for Growth scorecard. He doesn't take very conservative stands. He just kind of goes along to get along, and Chris McDaniel wants to shake that up. There are some concerns that Mississippi will be the new Alabama. As your listeners may recall, Alabama Republicans nominated Roy Moore, who then proceeded to lose to the Democrat. That sort of thing does not happen in the Deep South anymore. So there are some fears that Chris McDaniel is going to perhaps win in the primary but then lose in the general. I think that's a bit of a stretch. Chris McDaniel is no Roy Moore. He's definitely a conservative, but he's very polished and he knows how to articulate a message. So I think this is definitely one to watch. It will be a nationalized race. It will be conservatives versus the Republican Party. But it's definitely going to be very competitive and very, very vicious.
Now let's go to the volunteer state of Tennessee, where things are actually looking up.
Yeah, so Bob Corker, the Republican incumbent, decided to retire mainly because his public fights with Trump has made him so unpopular in Tennessee. So once that seat opened up, it now became an open seat race, and Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn announced, and conservatives immediately deemed her to be the conservative candidate. The Club for Growth PAC, the group that I work for, has endorsed her. The establishment tried to find a candidate. First, they went with Governor Bill Haslam, but he recognized the futility of running as an establishment candidate in Tennessee, so he declined to run. Then they found former Congressman Stephen Fincher. He decided to run. He ran against Blackburn, but his campaign never got off the ground, and so he suspended his campaign in the hopes that Corker would change his mind. And for a few weeks now, Corker has been trying to get back into the race, but all the polls showed that Marsha would mop the floor with him. So he decided to stay out. All of this ends with Marsha Blackburn being the only candidate left standing. And this is great news for conservatives, because then we can avoid a bloody primary and she can advance to the general as the GOP nominee unscathed. And I think that's a big victory, a bloodless victory, so to speak, for conservatives.
We will, of course, continue to keep an eye on all of these special elections and primary elections as they unfold throughout the spring and into the summer with Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. And Andy, a few words about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, we'll check in with you again next week.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Washington, D.C. has spent millions on a streetcar system that has fallen far short of expectations. Eric Boehm is joined by Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine for a look at the boondoggle. Eric?
Washington, D.C.'s streetcar is a pretty good metaphor for, well, just about everything in Washington, D.C., actually. It was the dream of big government planners. It fell well short of that goal, and it was way, way, way more expensive than initially planned. The streetcar runs for about 2 miles, it doesn't connect to anything useful, and it constantly gets stuck in D.C.'s awful traffic. It is a government boondoggle of the highest order. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Christian Britschke. He's an associate editor at Reason.com. He's a colleague of mine, and he writes about transportation policy, among other things, for us at Reason. And Christian, thanks for taking some time and being here on the show.
Oh, hey, thank you so much for having me on, Eric.
So you have a piece up at Reason.com this week looking at DC's struggles with getting replacement parts for its disastrous streetcar, but I think this is really just one part of a bigger story here, and I think we probably have to go back and talk about the basics first, because even people who live in Washington, D.C. might have never encountered the streetcar. I've lived here for a little while now. I don't think I've ever seen the thing in person, to be honest, and anyone who's ever come here as a tourist or just come here to visit probably hasn't seen it, because it runs for, like we said, for such a short distance in a part of the city where the tourists don't usually go. So let's go back here. Take us back 10 years or more, or whenever it was, when this was first proposed. What's the story behind the streetcar?
DC streetcar has been operating for just past its two-year anniversary yesterday, but the history of it goes back all the way to the early 2000s when the idea was first proposed. And the idea at the time was that they were going to build a 7-mile line out in Anacostia, east of the river, which is, if I'm familiar with DC, is kind of the lower income neighborhoods in DC. And the idea was that it would kind of like spur economic development in that area. That fell through pretty quickly. So they scaled down their vision dramatically in the early 2000s to instead build a 3-mile demonstration line there in Anacostia using existing railway tracks. Unfortunately, the owners of the tracks, they couldn't work a deal, and so they decided then that they were going to move it to just building it on the street. So they started building the track on the street. was going to go from Bowling Air Force Base to a stop on Pennsylvania Avenue there in Anacostia. Cost them about $20 million to get to that point. At that point, they decided, well, okay, Anacostia is not for us. What we're going to try and do then is build the DC streetcar on 8th Street, which for those who are not, again, not familiar with the city, is just a run of shops and bars along a stretch of road there. Their reasoning being that, well, we're already carrying up this road to pave it over, so we might as well put streetcar tracks down at the same time, be quick, save us money. But in, you know, their hastiness, they skipped out on some crucial design features, like deciding where they were going to put their maintenance shop, how much space they needed to give parked cars, and so forth. And so what ended up happening is when they finally started running vehicles, they ended up hitting a bunch of parked cars, including a police car at one point. And so this obviously added a lot of expense. They had to redesign things. They ended up having to spend $48 million on their car, or, you know, streetcar maintenance shop, when it should have cost them maybe $10 million or $20 million at most, if you look at comparable cities. And that brings us to today, where the streetcar started running in 2016, and by that point it had cost DC taxpayers $200 million
for a streetcar that runs 2 miles along 8th Street.
2 miles.
Oh, 2.2 miles. 2.2 miles. Excuse me. We'll get that right. That extra 2/10 of a mile makes a big difference. I think the late mayor of D.C., Marion Barry, probably summed it up pretty well. He said in 2014 that the streetcar was ill-planned, ill-thought-out, ill-engineered, ill-everything. And it's proving now, 4 years later, when it's finally up and running, it's proving exactly that, Christian. There's a whole new round of troubles with the streetcar, which you detailed this week. And the latest problem is what? They can't get replacement parts for these cars that are only 2 years old? What's going on here?
Yeah, that's right. A typical streetcar, according to guidance from the Federal Transit Administration, the vehicles vary, but your useful life should be 20, 25 to 31 years, generally. These streetcars, nevertheless, they're still going to have problems. They're still going to need replacement parts and so forth. The problem is DC's streetcar, some of them were made in the Czech Republic, so that makes it difficult to go to a Czech manufacturer all the time and import new parts for machines that are going to periodically need new parts. And then the other vehicles that they have were produced by, I believe it's called United Streetcar. I could be getting the name of the company wrong, but it's a Portland, Oregon company that shut down. And so one of their suppliers international, one of their suppliers out of business, means that they're having a very difficult time procuring parts to keep their vehicles running. And so what they're doing is they're considering, as they go and purchase new vehicles for planned extensions of the streetcar line, that they might just scrap their current vehicles that they have and replace them with new vehicles before their, you know, useful life might end.
Yeah, long, long time before their useful life might come to an end. We are talking with Christian Britschke. He's an associate editor at Reason.com, and he's got a piece this week looking at the troubles in the DC streetcar, and specifically the problems with the DC streetcar. But Christian, this is really a broader story. You cover transportation issues for us around the country, and there's this fascination with streetcars that has seemingly taken hold in the urban planning offices of cities all over the place. Is there anywhere in the country where these things have made sense, or where they've been cost effective, or are they just boondoggles everywhere?
No, not at least not in my opinion. The best performing streetcar is the one in New Orleans. It's about 25% its operating costs are paid for through ticket fees, user fare. Compare that to the Portland streetcar, which was one of the first of like this new round of streetcars where user fees pay for 4%, the rest being taxpayer subsidies. So these are a huge money loser. They run on a fixed track, so they're not flexible like buses. They generally don't move that many people. I would describe them more as a fashion statement than a transportation solution.
I think that about sums it up. It's a hipster fashion statement for cities to put in because they look cool. And I mean, I'll admit it. I guess they kind of look cool. They don't look as cool as the old streetcars, but they are just way, way too expensive to justify that. A very expensive transportation fashion statement brought to you by Christian Britschke. Christian, thanks for taking some time and being here on the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
That is Christian Britschke. He is an associate editor at Reason.com. You can check out his work right there at Reason.com or pick up the latest edition of Reason Magazine. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal, and we'll catch you right back here again next week.
While the media focuses on gun control, Dr. Paul Kangor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College digs deeper for the cause of school shootings on this American Radio Journal commentary.
What makes the recent school shooting in Florida especially tragic is it's commonplace. For the names of each dead teen, we could add the fatal names of other school shootings. Columbine, Sandy Hook, the Amish schoolhouse in central Pennsylvania, or even Virginia Tech. Where does this madness end? Well, I fear it only gets worse. This phenomenon is, above all, not a failure of gun laws or FBI checks or warning signs of mental illness. This is a descent from decency to the diabolical. And first and foremost, it's a catastrophic loss of values in our culture. Think about it. If this was merely a matter of guns, there would have been school shootings and church and other mass shootings in America for decades, if not centuries. No, this is new. I was recently talking to a 78-year-old who told me what I already knew. When he was in school in the 50s, he regularly brought his gun. He walked into school holding his .22 rifle, which he placed in his locker. Other boys did the same. The gym teacher after school grabbed his shotgun and drove the fields with him, shooting rabbits. And no one thought of shooting a classmate. My mother remembers her parents taking in hunters as boarders during deer season in Emporium, Pennsylvania. These men were strangers, often steel workers and coal miners coming up from Pittsburgh to hunt in the mountains. Many were World War II vets, surely some of them plagued by what we today call PTS. They brought ammo into the house and cleaned their rifles in their overnight bedrooms. My mom woke them up at 5 a.m., made them breakfast, and off they went into the snowy woods. And guess what? Not a single murder! This, too, was during the 1950s, a decade, incidentally, that liberals ridicule for its homey and hokey values. But let's leave the 50s out of this. After all, this civil America existed virtually every decade until recent times. When I was in high school in the early 1980s, we had a gun club. How many of you hearing this recall such clubs in your schools? They were everywhere. In 1984, New York State still had 65 school districts with rifle teams. The schools were not gun-free zones, and yet, no mass shootings. I remember coming home from school in the 1980s and routinely grabbing my 20-gauge shotgun and trekking across my suburban neighborhood on my way to the woods to hunt. No one blinked. Liberals will scoff at this as simplistic, but it truly is remarkable that the rise in gun violence in public schools follows the removal of God from public schools. Sure, added factors are at play, I agree, yet there's no way that it's a mere coincidence that our government schools are experiencing anarchy precisely as government purged Judeo-Christian values from the schools. Bibles are verboten, as is school prayer, as is any notion of instructing, let alone posting, the Ten Commandments, the Beatitudes, or the theological or cardinal virtues. Teacher friends of mine whispered their fears of getting fired as they struggle to carefully introduce any semblance of Christian moral ethics into their classrooms. We strip all of this, and then we expect our public schools to be paragons of propriety? What we have in America is an implosion of basic morality that no gun restrictions will fix. This nation's culture of Christendom that was its bedrock for over 200 years has been shattered, and now we're living with the results. Welcome to post-Christian America. Pretty ugly, isn't it? For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on John Paul II and Ronald Reagan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KIZA-FM in Williams Verde Valley, Arizona, KXRA-AM in Alexandria, Minnesota, and KAYQ-FM in Warsaw, Missouri. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.